Welcome to Open Spaces. I'm Willow Belden.
And I'm Bob Beck. Sublette County is home to two of Wyoming's major oil and gas fields, and emissions from the energy production have caused smog to form, a type of smog called ozone. Ground-level ozone can cause and exacerbate respiratory problems. It's also a problem for legal reasons. Ozone levels in Sublette County have exceeded federal limits several times in the past few years. Now the Environmental Protection Agency is stepping in. It's designating Sublette County a non-attainment area, which means Wyoming is obligated to fix the problem. But as Wyoming Public Radio's Willow Belden reports, there's no ready solution.
Here's a quick science lesson. Ground-level ozone forms when nitrogen oxides, or NOx, react with volatile organic compounds, also known as VOCs, under certain weather conditions. In Sublette County, the bulk of the NOx and VOC emissions come from the energy industry. Drill rigs, equipment that processes the oil and gas once it's extracted, and vehicle traffic all contribute. So several years ago, when the Wyoming Department of Environmental Quality found out about high ozone levels, they imposed new rules on the energy industry. Now, drilling equipment and all new production facilities in the area have to include special technology to cut down on emissions. Angela Zivkovich, an environmental engineer with Shell, shows me around a well pad near Pinedale. This site has four wells and a maze of other equipment, pipelines to transport gas and wastewater, heaters to keep the pipes from freezing, a dehydrator to separate the gas from the water that comes up with it, and storage tanks. Zivkovich points to a boxy piece of equipment.
All of this equipment is part of the dehydration unit, and its purpose is to remove the water from the gas.
The unit would normally emit large quantities of VOCs, but this dehydrator captures its emissions and sends them to a combustor, a tall tower that looks like a smokestack.
The heat destroys the VOC up to 98% efficiency, so 98% of those VOCs are now destroyed.
In addition to the combustor, the well site has been outfitted with other state-of-the-art green features meant to limit emissions. In this case, the green technology was required because the well pad is new. But John Cora, the head of the DEQ, says many facilities in the area were installed prior to the new rules, so they're exempt.
They're operating perfectly legally, but they emit a lot more than a well that we would permit today.
DEQ is pushing companies to voluntarily retrofit these grandfathered sites. They're also now requiring that if a company introduces a new source of emissions, say by drilling more wells, they now have to reduce emissions somewhere else. And they're pushing industry to cut down on drilling and vehicle traffic on days where ozone levels are expected to spike. John Cora says those measures are helping.
We've been able to reduce the NOx and VOX emissions, if you will, about 20 to 23%.
But we don't know if those reductions are enough to get ozone levels back down to federal standards. This past winter, ozone levels didn't spike nearly as high as in previous years, but that could also be a result of the weather or any number of other factors. So DEQ has a difficult task. They have to cut ozone by a set amount to comply with EPA regulations, and the only way to achieve that is to reduce emissions, but they don't know the magic number.
We can't tell you how much lower we have to cut these emissions.
It's kind of like knowing you need to lose 30 pounds in a certain time frame, but not knowing how much dieting and exercise it will take to lose those 30 pounds. The problem is, scientists still don't really understand the chemistry of wintertime ozone formation. They don't know the ratio of NOx to VOCs, they don't know exactly what type of VOCs are most problematic, and they haven't figured out exactly what weather conditions cause the pollutants to react. So DEQ is having a tough time coming up with a plan. Two atmospheric scientists at the University of Wyoming, Rob Field and Shay Murphy, are trying to help. They've been measuring air pollutants in Sublette County since the ozone problem was identified, and they're trying to answer some of the tough questions. Here's Rob Field.
The first 2 years of the project, our mission was to really establish, is it a locally generated ozone problem or is it being transported from outside? So we were able to show that it was indeed a local problem under particular meteorological conditions.
Next, they tried to identify the areas within Sublette County that had the highest concentrations of NOx and VOCs.
We've identified, for the VOCs, two main areas of higher concentrations, two let's call them hot spots. And so what we want to do in the future is be able to establish why are those areas, why are the concentrations higher there? And we've now got new tools that will enable us to categorically answer that question.
The tools are mobile devices that you can put in a vehicle. As you drive along, they measure the air quality. Field's colleague Shay Murphy says that will tell them which pieces of energy production equipment are causing the worst emissions.
So we can literally drive by a drill rig or drive by a pipeline or drive by a road with a lot of vehicles, and within seconds we can know if that's an important source or not.
The new devices will also differentiate between different types of VOCs that are emitted at each source, and we'll be able to see how fast they're reacting. And all of that will help find the answers DEQ needs. The research will likely take at least 2 more years to complete, though, and Wyoming is on a deadline. The state has 3 years to come back into attainment, or else stricter federal requirements will kick in. In the meantime, the DEQ has assembled a task force of citizens and industry reps to come up with recommendations about what to do. The task force had their third meeting last week in Pinedale. Participants had a wide range of ideas about what to do, everything from cutting off drilling altogether to running production equipment on solar power rather than fossil fuels. But so far, the group hasn't come up with any concrete recommendations. And some participants, like Pinedale Councilman David Hull, are frustrated.
One of my concerns about the task force is that it's a citizens' task force addressing a technical issue. And so that tells me that we're supposed to be PhD qualified here.
Hull says you need experts, not citizens, to make recommendations. Still, many task force participants are happy to be included in the discussion, and most are optimistic that now that the federal government is forcing Wyoming to fix the problem, the state will actually find a solution. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Willow Belden.
The Wyoming chapter of the American Civil Liberties Union has studied those who are in jail or in prison in Wyoming for a number of years. Wyoming is a state that likes to put people behind bars. The U.S. Justice Department notes that in 2010, Wyoming's crime rate was 17% lower than the national average, but Wyoming's incarceration rate is only 4% lower, meaning that if you commit a crime, you're probably going to get some time in this state. Linda Burt's the director of Wyoming's ACLU, and during an interview at her office in Cheyenne, she explained her organization looked at how those inmates are being treated.
Wyoming statutes don't require any particular direction in terms of treatment of prisoners other than some very minor things. And there's no inspection of the penitentiaries. There's no inspection of the jails. There's no rules or regulations that are provided for them. So it's very important that we assure that the jails and the penitentiary are meeting their constitutional requirements just in terms of the conditions in the jail.
Let's talk a little bit about what people are concerned about.
The largest number of complaints that we get are complaints about medical care or mental health care. Those are the biggest number. And beyond that, we get complaints about criminal cases, and of course we don't handle criminal cases for inmates. We also get complaints regarding safety of inmates. Those are another area of complaints. We get complaints about use of the law library or recreation facilities, those kinds of things. All of these things are required under the Constitution.
When we talk about health and mental health, what seems to be the problem there?
You know, I think one of the problems with mental health particularly is in a rural area, mental health care is difficult to provide. The other thing is psychotropic medications, those medications that people use when they have a mental illness, oftentimes are very expensive. They also need to be monitored very closely for any kind of side effects or negative effects for the inmate. One of the things that sometimes happens is that when an inmate goes into a jail, they've been on a psychotropic medication for their illness, and they are immediately taken off that medication. oftentimes because they're expensive, the jails don't like to pay for them. That is really a problem in terms of causing problems for health-wise for inmates, because you're not supposed to take inmates off of those medications immediately. The second thing is then they cause behavioral problems for the inmate and the staff, because those mental illness require that kind of assistance from drugs.
Now, what's the solution there? Are counties supposed to pay for that, or is this something they can bill to the inmate? I mean, what's the solution there?
Well, if an inmate is indigent, they must pay for their medical care and their drugs. If an inmate has money on their books, and sometimes relatives or family friends will go in and leave money on the books for an inmate to buy commissary items like candy, sweets, shampoo, those kinds of things. If an inmate has money on their books, the sheriff may charge the medication to the inmate. Also, if inmates have insurance or other ways to pay, the sheriff can charge those. But oftentimes, that's simply not the case with most inmates.
Is the situation that you believe that a lot of these facilities are choosing to ignore these things?
The reality of it is, and I think if you look at this report, you can see this, is most jails and the Wyoming Department of Corrections, they respond to the needs of the inmates. I think the penitentiary has been particularly good over the last couple of years. I think there are a number of jails, when you go through the report, you look, and you may see that they have a lot of complaints, but the reality of it is, and when I say a lot, I mean between 10 and 15. So this would be 10 and 15 complaints from a particular jail in a year. But the reality of those complaints, when we look back at them, we see those are complaints that were resolved quickly by a phone call to the jail administrator, by a phone call to the county attorney, and the jails did respond and fix the problem that was going on. There are a couple of jails in Wyoming that don't do that, unfortunately, that are more difficult to work with, but the majority of jails are very good in terms of their response.
You've had some success, truthfully, with litigation and that sort of thing. I imagine that gets people's attention as you try and resolve an issue.
Well, one of the cases that we did in 2004 was called Genest, and it was a case against the Wyoming Penitentiary, as I recall. And that case now has a Tenth Circuit holding, which is one of the holdings that requires medical response for serious medical need, and it really is part of the case law now in Wyoming of how medical needs have to be responded to. So yes, you know, oftentimes litigation becomes the only option that you have when you've tried everything else. Our foundation and what we look at in terms of a case is actually trying everything, making sure that we cannot remedy that case in any other way.
Now, I had a conversation with the sheriff about this once, and I imagine this is going to be in thought of a number of our listeners listening to our conversation. Hey, they're bad people. They're in jail. Why do we have to bend over backwards here? Would you respond to that?
You know, and I think, and pardon me, I have to correct myself. It wasn't Wyoming Department of Correction. It was Carbon County, which was the case law, the Genest case.
And Bob Lampert appreciates that correction.
Yes. Well, I did want to correct that. I'm sure he does. You know, that's one of the problems that we do have in terms of providing care for inmates is that, you know, inmates are the last people that taxpayers care about, and medical care can be very expensive. But the reality of it is, and we get these calls often, suddenly it's someone's son or it's someone's husband or it's someone's brother. They've never had anyone in jail and they're calling because their friend or their son is not getting their medication. And it becomes very important at that particular point in time. The other issue is a constitutional issue. And the Eighth Amendment says no cruel and unusual punishment. Not treating people for medical for medical conditions is cruel and unusual punishment under the Constitution.
As I read the report, though, and I think you alluded to this, very rare instances here where this is going on.
You know, yes, and when there are problems and problems do arise, I think there are problems in the jails, and And those problems are understaffing, those problems are lack of funds, and I think those problems will continue. People don't like to fund jails, and it's a problem. And those are oftentimes where we see our biggest problems. It's because the jail is underfunded, because it is understaffed. I know Laramie County now is looking at a larger and larger medical bill this year, and it's larger than any bill they've ever had, because medical costs continue to rise, and it's a problem for all of us. So I think it's something that continues to need to be monitored. I think the other issue is, it's because we have had successful lawsuits, and because we do monitor, I think that keeps problems from cropping up and problems from getting worse.
Linda Bird, always nice chatting with you. Thank you.
And thank you, Bob.
When we come back, we'll hear about an innovative partnership between two Wyoming hospitals. This is Open Spaces.
This is Open Spaces from Wyoming Public Radio News. I'm Bob Beck.
And I'm Willow Belden. The Cheyenne Regional Medical Center and the Wyoming Medical Center in Casper are considering a partnership which they believe may be necessary to remain financially strong in the future. They're looking at ways to share things from medical providers to joining together to enhance health care across the state. Wyoming Public Radio's Bob Beck reports that neither hospital CEO is positive the partnership will work, but they both believe they need to give it a shot in order to remain financially viable.
All right, this morphine will be for your pain. Just goes through your IV.
This is the emergency room of the Cheyenne Regional Medical Center. A doctor talks to a patient behind a curtain. Nurses check vital signs and paramedics fill out paperwork. Like a lot of hospitals in the country, it is at a crossroads. With the cost of healthcare increasing and competition from specialists in Colorado, the hospital is looking into a partnership with the Wyoming Medical Center in Casper to see if working together can improve affordability, patient access, and quality. But maybe more importantly, allow both hospitals to stay competitive. John Lucas is the CEO of Cheyenne Regional.
So we want to make sure that we're the choice for Wyoming residents in terms of our doctors and our hospitals. We want to be the choice. We want to keep care in Wyoming.
Right now, that's been a challenge in particular for Cheyenne, who's having a tough time competing with the specialists in Colorado. Lucas says by working with the hospital in Casper, they could either share specialists or more easily afford their own. They could also consolidate administrative services to save money and possibly do other things.
We want to look at optimizing and regionalizing our clinical programs. So we want to be more than providing care in Casper in Cheyenne. We would like to provide care across most of the state.
While providing good care to more people might be part of that goal, both hospitals believe the key to long-term survival is to improve their reach. That's because they're losing patients and revenue when people leave the state. The president of the Cheyenne Regional Board of Trustees, Dr. Gene Halpern, says if patients from border hospitals go out of state, the loss of revenue could force the reduction of health care.
The attrition does potentially put more and more pressure on our local hospitals to be able to provide the care that we want to our local populations.
In Casper, Wyoming Medical Center CEO Vicki Diamond says rising costs and pressure from outside interests tell her that if some sort of action is not taken, it could impact the type of local health care residents can get. That's why she's a fan of the partnership concept.
We're all facing major health care reform going on, and the reimbursement system's changing. And we also are being very aggressively approached, many of our hospitals, by out-of-state systems wanting to take that higher-end specialty care out-of-state. Also, we need to be more efficient in our care delivery and reduce our cost. And we can do that better together than by ourselves.
Diamond says one other benefit of a partnership is that the hospitals could share specialists that might not have the volume to remain in Wyoming. She says that's actually happening now.
Both of us have two heart surgeons. We both need, based on volume, 1.5 heart surgeons. So Cheyenne lost a heart surgeon. So instead of them hiring another heart surgeon, our heart surgeons agreed to go down and fill in the halftime position. That's what we envision going forward.
The other thing that both hospital administrators see happening is working with other hospitals and medical providers in Wyoming to see if they can expand this partnership across the state. That's caught the attention of Wyoming's medical community. Dr. Cynthia Casey provides rural primary care in the Gillette area. She understands the economics of such a partnership, but she admits there's a level of discomfort.
My concern is that as these larger facilities consolidate, the unintended consequence of that is that they're going to force out the traditional private practitioner and maybe even force the closure of some of the smaller community hospitals who simply cannot compete economically.
And while both hospitals see their partnership as a long-term plan of improving healthcare coverage in the state, Dr. Casey has her doubts.
I believe that it's the best route they can go to maintain the access those two facilities already provide for their patients. It's difficult for me to see how that's going to improve access and quality care throughout the state away from those two areas.
Still, she admits that if Wyoming residents not located near the state border at any point are forced to leave the state for specialty care, that's a problem. Wyoming Medical Center's Vicki Diamond says that's why this discussion is so important.
We could actually have to reduce services. And we're a tertiary referral center. We do the most trauma in the state. You know, we might not be able to provide all of that. And that when that happens, people in Wyoming die because you have to be transferred out of state for those things. Time is critical.
While medical personnel at Cheyenne Regional mill around in the ER, CEO John Lucas says administrators have some very important decisions to make. He believes that if the two hospitals can work out the details, this could be a very important decision for healthcare in the state. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Bob Beck.
The Wyoming Community Development Authority is encouraging people to buy houses, especially if they've never owned a home before. They're launching a campaign called Buy Now, putting up flyers in real estate offices and offering classes to help first-time buyers navigate the process of purchasing a home. The group's executive director, David Haney, joins us now to talk about the initiative. He says conditions are excellent for buyers at the moment.
Today is an absolutely terrific time for folks, particularly first-time home buyers, to step up and, if they're comfortable with their employment situation, to buy a new home. Interest rates are as low as they have ever been. Prices have pretty much stabilized throughout most of Wyoming. So the combination of both those things makes for a really terrific time to buy.
Looking at it from a slightly different perspective, why is it important then for more people to be buying houses?
Well, I think that home ownership continues to be a foundation for both our economy and people's lives. And the more stability that exists in that arena, typically the healthier our communities are. The choice of renting versus purchasing is still certainly one that is very important for folks, but if you do have a desire to purchase, now is a very, very good time to do that.
Isn't it a little risky to be encouraging a lot of people to buy houses? I mean, couldn't one be contributing to another housing bubble with that? Obviously, you know, some people will be able to afford the houses, other people might not be. And might you not be encouraging people to buy houses who then would not be able to afford the payments?
Obviously, today's environment is much different than it might have been back in the mid-2000s when there was a good deal less scrutiny for buyers to determine whether or not they could afford to buy what they were looking to buy. One of the things that all of our borrowers participate in is a very aggressive home buyer education counseling period that actually walks people through the process so it's not a complete unknown for them. It also looks at their personal budgets very critically and carefully to make sure that people understand the risks and potential rewards that will come with having a stable home environment.
So what advice do you have for listeners who may be considering buying a house? What should they do? What should they not do as they're weighing the options here?
I think the very first thing that they should be doing before they ever go to a lender or a realtor or anything else, take the home buyer education class. It's available online at a very nominal cost. There's also a very comprehensive one-on-one counseling that takes place to look at budgets and talk about the relative expenses that one is likely to have with home ownership. So if my son came to me and said, gee, where would I start? I would start right there. Then you can take the step to either go to your lender, and they can also take a look at the pre-qualification process and allow people to carry with them a letter to their local realtor that says, I can afford a $200,000 house, but I can't afford a $300,000 house. And then they look at the $200,000 houses instead of going out and having stars in their eyes looking at something that they ultimately can't afford.
All right. Well, thank you so much.
You bet. Well, I'll thank you.
That was David Haney, Executive Director of the Wyoming Community Development Authority. He was talking with us about his group's efforts to encourage Wyoming residents to buy houses.
When we come back, we will learn why some are concerned about the water situation in the state, and Casper has a new policy concerning its landfill. This is Open Spaces. Welcome back to Open Spaces from Wyoming Public Radio News. I'm Bob Beck.
And I'm Willow Belden. We're joined now by Lee Hackelman. He's a water supply specialist with the Natural Resources Conservation Service, and he's with us to talk about what the warm, dry spring means for Wyoming. He says the snowpack has gotten extremely low, which will make for a tough year.
We were doing great till the 1st of March. Since March come along, we've had warm weather and not very much snow, so we got up to like 100% at the 1st of March, and it's just been steadily downhill since then. Just every week seemed like it just goes down, down, down. We're at 22% for the state now, so pretty soon we're going to hit like 0%, you know, when everything gets melted out. And last year at this time, we were at 200%. So it's going to be pretty poor for a lot of farmers out there.
What parts of the state are particularly hard hit by this?
Well, it looks like the northwest corner is faring better than the rest of the state. Stuff coming out up around the park, up around Jackson and stuff, they're going to have pretty near a normal. It's still going to be below normal, but it's going to fare better than the rest of the state. All the rest of the state is going to be low. It's just no doubt about it.
So does this mean we're headed for a drought?
Well, not necessarily, because, you know, we could still get some rains and stuff. But the trouble with the rains, for, at least farmer-wise, is that the water will run high for a couple days, and they might not be set up to irrigate those 2 days, and then it'll be gone, where if you got snow melt, it's just kind of melting off all the time, and they can grab it whenever they need it. If you're below a reservoir, most all the reservoirs this year are in great shape, so anybody below a reservoir will probably end up getting pretty much their full water right. It is if you have enough storage, I guess. There's some farmers out there that only have a partial reservoir right, so they'll end up being a little short too, but not as short as the people that are in direct diversion. People that only have direct diversion are going to be way short this year.
So what does this mean for irrigators who are above reservoirs, who are not getting their water from reservoirs? What are their prospects for this year?
Well, if any of them can remember back to 1977, that was the last year in our records anyway, showing it was like dry like this year. I think we're even going to be drier than 77, but most everybody only got half their normal amount. So they're very used to getting 3 or 4 feet of, you know, irrigating water. They're only going to get 2, you know, so it might be a good idea for a lot of farmers out there to idle some of their land and only farm their best land this year.
So is that going to be is this going to make a big impact on crops and hay production and things like that?
Yeah. Yeah, there'll be a lot of people that will probably get first cut and irrigated but won't have any water for their second cut. Our surrounding states are all dry too, so unless we get a lot of rain where they can put up a lot of grass hay, it's liable to be a hay shortage again this winter. So,
what is that going to mean for livestock in the state?
Probably higher hay prices again, or at least alfalfa hay.
What can people do to sort of make the whole situation easier to handle? I mean, what recommendations would you have for, let's say, people who are living above reservoirs?
I think I would, any kind of marginal land they have, I think I would hold off on irrigating it and just use the water on their best land. I think if they plant fence row to fence row this year, they're going to have a lot of it burn up. So, you know, I would probably cut back.
So obviously this year the reservoirs are in good shape just because we had so much snow last year. If we were to get another similarly dry, warm winter this coming winter, what would that mean for Wyoming?
Well, then everybody would really be hurting, not just the people above the reservoirs. People below the reservoirs would be kind of in the same boat. So let's hope that don't happen.
All right. Well, thanks so much for talking with me.
Okay.
That was Lee Hackelman with the Natural Resources Conservation Service. He was talking with us about the warm, dry weather that Wyoming has been having and what it will mean for the state.
Casper has begun banning grass clippings and other yard waste from the trash that goes into their landfill. Officials expect it to save the city tens of thousands of dollars, but people who are into living green are very excited too. Wyoming Public Radio's Rebecca Martinez reports.
Hear that? That's the sound of Casper saving money. Okay, it's the sound of a mulch mower. Casper Parks Department employee Ryan Pryor is cutting the grass in Mike Cedar Park on a sunny afternoon. The mower looks like a typical ride-on, but it doesn't have a bag collecting clippings. The mulch mower chops the clippings into tiny particles and deposits them back into the grass, fertilizing the lawn. That means the grass the Parks Department cuts doesn't take up valuable space in Casper's landfill. The city has to install an expensive liner in each of the landfill's cells and then stack trash and cover it up every day, so space is money. Yard waste makes up about 18% of what goes into the landfill, so on May 1st, Casper initiated its gradual ban on putting it in your garbage can. Cindy Langston is the city's director of solid waste.
Yard waste is the easiest thing for us to divert, and we get a big bang for our buck. We're getting 4 to 5 tons more grass out of the landfill with the yard waste that's being diverted in the Thursday trash route right now.
Cheyenne implemented a similar yard waste ban almost a decade ago. Both cities operate compost yards to reuse the biodegradable waste that comes in. Casper has banned yard waste from the Thursday trash route this year and plans to have the ban in place citywide within 5 years. By then, the city should be able to divert more than 18,000 tons of waste per year, saving more than $62,000 annually.
When this comes into your part of the neighborhood, you need to remember not to put your grass and your flowers and your leaves and your branches in that trash container.
Instead, you can haul all that, don't forget to separate the branches out, to the landfill for no charge. If you don't want to make the trip, you can arrange for the city to pick up your grass clippings and leaves in a separate container for $10 a month. The city will pick up all residents' bundled branches once a month at no additional charge. It all comes here, to the compost yard by the landfill. Mountains of discarded tree branches stand in view of giant heaps of wood chips of varying grain sizes. Behind the hills of sod and manure hauled in from the fairgrounds, the city's compost specialist, Clint Sparger, drives a bulldozer over some fresh asphalt where he'll make the next few hundred yards of compost.
We mix it together in a windrow, use the downsized wood chips and the green grass and the leaves and a little bit of manure in with it. And then we water all that up real good and air it up with our turner we have, and then it heats up and cooks down and makes a nice compost.
The city uses the compost and wood chips in its landscaping, and commercial operations can fill up the bed of a pickup truck with it for about $18. Residents who haul their yard waste can request a voucher for free compost or wood chips in exchange. Cindy Langston says about half of the people who haul yard waste in take advantage of that program. According to city surveys, about half of Casper residents support yard waste diversion. Only about 1% complained about having to pay for grass pickup or haul it themselves.
Look. Better put it in there. Good job.
Across town, Casper resident and organic gardener Jean Proctor looks on as her daughter and granddaughter pull weeds and rocks from her backyard garden, where she'll grow melons and tomatoes this summer. She hasn't been affected by the yard waste ban yet, but loves that it goes into compost that residents can use.
I think that's awesome. I seriously do, because we haven't really got a compost pile started. Most people don't have a composter or chipper shredder, and so it's a real need for gardeners to use that service that they have. I think it's awesome.
Solid Waste Director Cindy Langston is proud of the compost and wood chip program, but she wouldn't mind seeing less yard waste coming in altogether. She's really pushing mulch mowing, encouraging residents to switch up their lawnmower blade, ditch the collection bag, and send the tiny grass particles back into the soil.
Any time that you can actually not generate a waste, it's actually better for the environment. If you look at recycling, which compost is recycling, you're actually spending fuel to go to the landfill, and then we're spending fuel to actually compost it and labor. So there's a lot of energy and resources used to recycle and get it back into the stream.
Langston swears mulch mowing often and properly does not leave stray blades of grass all over your lawn. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Rebecca Martinez.
When we come back, it'll be the art segment of our show. It's the anniversary of a museum in Jackson, and we'll hear from a pair of Wyoming writers. This is Open Spaces.
Welcome back to Open Spaces. I'm Willow Belden.
And I'm Bob Beck. This week, the National Museum of Wildlife Art in Jackson Hole is celebrating its 25th anniversary. It kicks off a number of events that will be part of the celebration. The museum was a dream that's come a long ways from its humble beginnings. We're joined on the phone by one of the co-founders, Bill Kerr, who says the idea was to feature art that may have been overlooked.
As Western art was for decades, wildlife art was largely ignored or considered an illustration art. And my wife and I believed, and others in our founding group believed, that wildlife art was a distinct art form on its own and deserved recognition in the greater body of American art. We opened originally as Wildlife of the American West in a 5,000-square-foot converted office building on the Jackson Town Square. And we operated there for 7.5 years before taking the plunge to build the 51,000-square-foot facility on a 70-acre campus just north of Jackson.
Was it always something that people believed in there?
The hardcore. It was a combination of faith in the value of the art and to be perfectly honest, naivete on the part of many of us who didn't fully understand the magnitude of the undertaking we were involved with.
Now, you actually helped get the collection started, is that right?
Joffa and I had been collecting wildlife art with animals in it since the early 60s. So it had been pretty much a passionate avocation for us most of our marriage.
Now, was it hard to get others to contribute to this museum?
No, sir. The Jackson community really responded. The Buchenroth family, the Mead Hansen family, Sam Leitner and the Jack Dennis store here. We were really fortunate the way people in the community who liked the same kind of art we liked were willing to put their money where their taste was.
One of the things that has just struck me was the type of collection that you in fact have there, and I would imagine that as you try to grow the collection and take big steps that you are probably competing with some bigger museums. Is that accurate?
Yes and no. Bob, we have a unique niche in that the wildlife art genre is not the focus of hardly any other institutions in the country. There are a few. But when you have a great painting by Georgia O'Keeffe that has an antelope, a pronghorn skull set against a New Mexico landscape in it, yeah, you're competing against any museum in the country that wants an O'Keeffe.
Bill Kerr again visiting with us, one of the co-founders of the National Museum of Wildlife Art in Jackson Hole, which is celebrating its 25th anniversary. One of the other things that I think you've done that's been genius is you've been able to bring some really big name speakers, sometimes to talk about wildlife and sometimes to talk about other topics. It's become a very important focal point for, I think, the community and any visitors that might be up there when folks have come. Do you agree that that's something that also has helped bring a little stature?
Yes, it helps engage the community. Local folks aren't going to come to the museum every week just because they love the art. But if Justice O'Connor, Sandra Day O'Connor, is here making a presentation, we have a full house. When Mrs. Cheney comes and talks to us about her family history and her wonderful books, we have a full house. So those kinds of events are very important.
Well, one of the things you're doing this year in celebrating the 25th anniversary is going to be a number of events. Would you like to run through some of the highlights for us?
Coming up this summer, we have a three-day sequence of an unveiling of a bronze presidential eagle done by the artist Sandy Scott, who lives in Lander. The eagle has a 25-foot wingspan. It's impressive. It was originally commissioned for the Clinton Presidential Library in Little Rock. And on the same weekend, we have a plein air festival out on our new sculpture trail that'll have 40 Wyoming artists painting outside for people to interact with and observe how they produce their beautiful works of art. We have another sculpture unveiling on July 12th by the United Kingdom British sculptor Simon Gudgeon, who is bringing an 8-foot ibis for us. It's the original ibis that he did was cast and is in Hyde Park in London. These are significant events that are coming up in the next 6 weeks.
Bill Kerr is the co-founder of the National Museum of Wildlife Art in Jackson Hole, celebrating 25 years this week. Thanks so much for joining us.
Bob, thank you.
Wyoming Public Radio has developed a partnership with the University of Wyoming Master of Fine Arts program. Those in the program are being trained to develop their writing. We're now going to feature two of those writers. The first one is poet Kristen Gunther, who reads her poem called The Owl.
A dark shock of blue kicked at fingerbone aspens, breakfast fire built by handfuls, an altar of twigs. I remembered the owls, dream vivid. Star clutters, small moon, dead light on dry leaves, blown down, dense as galaxies, above all the owls. Only now, alone fireside, do I recall old coasts. Do I recall those midnights at battered porch screens? Do I remember calling, measuring silence, waiting for the sound turned back? More than hear it, I feel, paroxysm of gut and throat, shapeless as the ghost I was told the owl must proceed. Now, beyond spindling trees, huge rocks rise and fresh light, seed of owlcry echo. Can I know? Was there one bird or two? I cannot say, though the night was clear, though my voice is clear. I'm Kristen Gunther.
During our relationship with the Master of Fine Arts program, we've also acquired some people who wanted to learn to be public radio reporters. Three people have joined us, including this next writer. Irina Zhorov is an accomplished photographer who wanted to develop her writing skills. She recently graduated from the MFA program. When Irina came to Wyoming from Philadelphia, she had questions about her new state. Today, she tells us about her conclusions in her letter to Wyoming.
We are friends now, Wyoming, so I feel I can be honest. I thought you were a loser when we first met. You were lonely and vengeful with your wind, your plains like cold, empty bedsheets tucked into snow-covered mountains, polka-dotted with undulates and dead towns. But then on that coldest day, do you remember? We boiled water and threw it in the crisp air, and it turned to snowflakes, and I started to fall for you. In the dead towns, I met cowboys with their throats wrapped in silk wild rags, and on roads where you can drive fast, I found steely skies that stretched out into impossible horizons. At the Hobo Hot Springs, I met a man that looked like a Viking, and in the forest, I prospected for gold in the glacial streams, and on a ranch, I fished snakes out of a canal, and in the mountains, I traced petroglyphs with my finger, and everywhere, I watched trains trudge across landscapes in endless caravans, and I met people with faces open as the land, soft-spoken as the ready snow, with belt buckles big as the sky. I ran my hands against your thick seams of coal in the basin, too, and I have not forgotten your whiteouts that made it seem like the world was made of cold cotton candy. Also, I'm still not sure about these loud souped-up trucks, dear. And I remember Matthew Shepard and my landlord, who thought I had an attitude problem because she couldn't pronounce my name. Sometimes, too, the loneliness and the starkness still reign. This isn't goodbye, Wyoming. This isn't a proposition of any sort. I sunned yesterday on granite slabs in a field of blue columbines, and tomorrow it may snow. And I feel all right about that. I thought I would let you know just that, that you're all right, dear. I'm Irina Zhorov.
Thanks for listening to this edition of Open Spaces. If you have comments about the show, you may submit them on our website at wyomingpublicmedia.org. There you may listen to our entire show, individual segments, or pitch ideas for future programs.
Tara Orr and Rebecca Martinez are in charge of our web content. We also invite you to become a fan of Wyoming Public Radio News on Facebook, and you may follow our news team on Twitter. Open Spaces is a production of Wyoming Public Radio News.